From current climate change to paleoclimate change, this is the Perpetual Notion Machine for Thursday, January 24th, 2019. I'm your host, Matt Blackburn. It should be safe to say that climate change is real. Some measurements put the amount of carbon in the atmosphere at 410 parts per million, and the effects of climate change are real too. More and bigger wildfires, stronger hurricanes, and flooding from extreme rainfalls. We in Madison know about that. But today's climate change isn't unique. There have been atmospheric changes and temperature rises that go back millions of years. And a new study came out just last month that compares past climate change to what's going on today and what will be happening in the future. Our guest tonight is Jack Williams. Jack is a paleoecologist and professor of geography at UW-Madison. And now here's PNMer Dennis Schaefer with our guest.
Oh, thanks, Matt. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
As I mentioned before the show, I wanted to do a lot of research on this thing. I got a dozen questions. First off, let me just ask you, in general, does Earth's climate go through cycles? Is there a pattern? I know we've had ice ages that are more recent than sort of the geological length of time that we've had on Earth, but...
Yeah, that's right. Really, what's really fun and interesting about the climate system is it does lots of things all at once. On very long timescales, over tens of millions of years, we've seen the Earth cooling. There's been a long-term cooling from the age of the dinosaurs about 65 million years ago. And those were greenhouse climates back then. And now we're in what we call ice house climates now, where over that 50 to 60 million years, the world has cooled. And now we've entered this period of these ice ages. And now, over the last, say, 1 to 3 million years, we've had these cyclical variations that you were talking about, where we go from colder periods, the ice ages or the glacials, to these warmer periods called the interglacials. And Until recently, we were living something we call the Holocene interglacial. The last 10,000 years has been a relative warm period in this longer cycle of these cold and warm glacials and interglacials.
Then I'm just sort of wondering, let me ask you this. In your research as a paleontologist or a paleoecologist, exactly what do you look for? What kinds of evidence do you try to gather? And how does that tell you what period of time that came from?
There's so many different places we go to look for paleoclimatic records. There's so many different what we call proxies, signals of past climates, and there's so many different ways we date. There's a whole field of geochronology to figure out how old different rocks are. So each one of them is our whole disciplines unto themselves. Probably the most famous one that people know about are the ice cores, where Greenland, we have the ice cores that go back 100,000 years, and in Antarctica, they have ice cores there. That ice is maybe 800,000, possibly a million years old. So when you drill ice in Antarctica, you can go back 800,000 years. Now in those ice cores, for example, what we can measure is little pockets of air that are little samples of the air from 800,000 years ago, which is really amazing. And then there are isotopes in that water, oxygen isotopes and hydrogen isotopes, and the relative proportions of heavier and light isotopes is temperature sensitive. So you looking at the water composition, the chemistry of the water itself frozen in those ice sheets tells us something about the temperature of snowfall when that snow fell on Antarctica 800,000 years ago.
Is there, based on the current evidence, anything, you know, ice cores is probably during the ice ages, not anything like millions of years ago, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, right. So to have ice cores implies ice ages, and so we talk about the dinosaurs, and during the greenhouse climates, there really was no permanent ice in any large scale anywhere in the world. And so to go that far back, one thing that people use quite a bit of are ocean sediments. Oceans are accumulating mud at a very steady rate at the bottom of the ocean floor. And when we have ocean drilling vessels, we have a U.S. ocean drilling program, there's international ocean drilling programs that send out drill ships to take, you know, very long cores of mud, and those records can go back 60 million years quite often. So those do go back through this full time period back to the age of the dinosaurs.
Well, so what kinds of evidence is that? Is that the same thing? Is that Can you see what the carbon content is?
Yeah. So from those ocean sediments, for example, there's a whole bunch of things that people look at these days. Again, isotopes, the ratio of these different oxygen atoms tells us something about temperature at the time. We can actually look at the animals and living in those, and they are temperature sensitive. So looking at the communities, and like, we have like lots of species that today are found in polar waters. If you find those species, that's a signal that things were cold back then. You can find something called ice rafted debris. When an iceberg floats out over some part of the ocean and then melts, it drops sand and bits of gravel down to the ocean sediment. Those bits are too large to be transported by any other mechanism than the icebergs themselves.
Okay.
So that becomes a proof positive of icebergs floating out somewhere over the ocean floor. And these days, there's a whole field of organic geochemistry where people are using all these individual molecular compounds, things that we call biomarkers, that are also temperature sensitive. So there's a whole range of different signals, geochemical, physical, biological, that we can pull from ocean sediments that give us a fairly complete picture of past climates and past environments.
Now, getting back to the time periods, you got a lot of different kinds of evidence. Not all of it is carbon related, but is carbon dating, does that kind of give you an idea of the time frame?
Yeah, so let me talk about two parts about carbon, because one thing we want to talk about is when there's been carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's one aspect. But carbon dating, you know, there's three different isotopes of carbon: carbon-12, carbon-13, carbon-14.
Okay.
Each has six protons, and they differ in the number of neutrons, 6, 7, and 8 neutrons in the nucleus. Of those three, carbon-14 is radioactive. It decays away and breaks down at a known rate.
Okay.
But as it breaks down at a known rate, we could use as a clock to figure out how old something is based on the amount of that radioactive isotope in those sediments.
Okay.
Radiocarbon breaks down relatively quickly, which means that we can only use it as a clock going back about 40,000 years. There are other radioactive isotopes, like uranium, that have much slower decay rates, like millions to billions of years. So that we use different radioisotopes as different geological clocks at different timescales.
Okay. Getting back to a little bit about your research that got published last month, you referenced two particular time frames, epochs.
Yeah.
correct me if I'm wrong, Pliocene.
That's right.
And the Eocene.
Yep.
How long ago were those?
So the Pliocene is roughly, 3 million years ago, give or take. You know, we'll use that as a ballpark number here. And the Eocene, about 50 million years ago.
Yeah, yeah. What happened during those particular times? Can you describe what the Earth looked like then?
Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, one of the long-term trends over the last 50 to 60 million years has been this long-term cooling of the Earth system. So when we go back to the Eocene, maybe 50 million years ago, that's kind of the age of the dinosaurs, or just after it, right?
Okay.
So a warm greenhouse world, no ice sheets in Antarctica, no ice sheets in Greenland. It's pretty much an ice-free world at that point. It's the dawn of mammal evolution. So the dinosaurs have just gone away, and all these various mammals are now radiating outwards, and new lineages are forming. Horses trace back to about that time period. Whales trace back. So, but when we talk about going back to the climates of the Eocene, we're talking of going back, you know, rewinding the evolutionary and environmental clock to some degree by about 50 million years in terms of the climates experienced by those animals then versus what we and the species around us today have experienced now.
Yeah. I want to talk about the Pliocene and then get back to the Eocene.
Mm-hmm.
The Pliocene's a little more recent.
That's right.
3 million years, you said?
Mm-hmm.
So in your study, you kind of reference what's happening today with what happened back then. Is that just generally, let me ask you this, in terms of what we study climate change, there are a lot of things that reference climate change, mostly a lot of its effects, but it sort of substantiates what's happening. But when we go down, we always think of it, climate change is happening because of the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and then the rise in temperature. Is that the key to understanding what the climate was, climate change, or what was the climate like back in the Pliocene?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, very much so. When we look at the history of temperature variations globally, going back through all these timescales, and again, we do have good indicators of what these temperature variations were, and then we have records of what carbon dioxide variations were in the atmosphere, we tend to see a pretty close correspondence between the two. We can establish that very precisely for the last 800,000 years, where we have these ice cores with these actual little bubble samples of the air. So we really know to a few parts per million what were CO2 levels in the atmosphere 700, 800,000 years ago. You know, and so that's really remarkable when you think about it. On longer timescales, going back to the Pliocene, Eocene, we have to use more indirect signals of CO2, and they're a little bit less precise.
Oh,
but nonetheless, okay. What we tend to see is that when you have greenhouse climates, you have more CO2 in the atmosphere, like the age of the dinosaurs. When you go to the ice house climates, you see less CO2 in the atmosphere. And so this leads to all kinds of interesting questions. To a first order, it confirms well-known physical principles. We've known for 100 years that CO2 is a greenhouse gas and that right. It traps infrared radiation. So if you have more CO2 in the atmosphere, you're going to have more surface warming. And so the geological record really confirms that well-understood and expected phenomenon. What then becomes interesting is what causes CO2 to go up and down in the past. Nowadays, it's fossil fuels. We're burning fossil fuels. And again, we know very clearly that by burning fossil fuels, we put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we've been doing so ever since the Industrial Revolution started. On geological timescales, it really gets interesting. There's a lot of work trying to figure out how the carbon cycle works in deeper time. It actually starts to do with, and just really to think about it, so one on these long timescales, why did the Earth cool over the last 50 million years? Some people think it's because as the Himalayas rose up and were, as India collided into Asia, this is plate tectonics, these plates are moving around, as India collided into Asia, that created the Himalayas. They were pushed up and became these mountain ranges. As they pushed up, they started to weather more quickly. They started to react with rainfall and carbon dioxide. And that weathering, that chemical weathering of those rocks actually removes carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So these very long timescales, there's what people call the silicate carbonate, carbon weathering feedbacks that as you start to increase the rates of rock erosion and weathering, you actually draw CO2 out of the atmosphere into these weathering byproducts.
Well, let me ask you this other thing. One of the things that has come up over time lately is, you know, deforestation. Cutting a lot of trees, you know, in, exacerbates the, you know, climate change because we don't have trees sucking the carbon out. But back in the other time, you know, that time, you know, we weren't destroying the forests or anything like that. Was there anything like, I mean, even the oceans are really, you know, some even say today that the oceans might be the real key to sucking the carbon out of the atmosphere today.
Yeah.
Was that something that happened back then? Or was it something unusual that happened that kept the climate carbon or temperatures?
So, you know, it's really helpful when you think about the carbon cycle. Think about where does carbon live? And it can be in the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide or methane. It can be in the rocks and these, as I talk about these weathering products.
Right.
It can be in plants. It can be in the soil. It can be in the ocean. And so at different timescales, there's different processes that move carbon and carbon dioxide among these different surface reservoirs. Right now, what we're doing is that we are cutting down trees and we're clearing land. And that carbon that was in those forests gets burned or respires and goes in the atmosphere. So land use and land cover change is a source of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere now. Also, now the ocean is actually slowing down climate change because the ocean is taking CO2 from the atmosphere, and plants are, it looks like they're having some stimulus to their photosynthesis. They are taking more CO2. There's a land sink and an ocean sink that's taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and partially counteracting the additions we're making through fossil fuel burning and our deforestation. Okay, but you asked about the past. There's kind of a long answer here. In the past, we know that rock weathering is a big control in these long timescales, and we do know that the ocean is an important sink as well. There is, during the glacial periods, we talked about the ice ages and that cyclical process. Probably what's happening on those timescales is carbon dioxide moving from the oceans to the atmosphere and back to the oceans again. So during the cold glacials, the ocean sucks up that CO2. During the warm interglacials, it outgasses that CO2 back into the atmosphere again.
Yeah, okay. So when the continents shifted, that created more water around, But then during the ice ages, there's a temperature warm, the ice or the snow melted, creating a lot more water and evaporation.
That's right. A simple rule of thumb is that a warmer atmosphere has more water in it. The simple relationship that a warm summer day can hold more water than a cold day. So you expect a warmer atmosphere to have more water, increased rates of weathering, increased rainfall, extreme events, storm events, et cetera.
Yeah, I wanted to ask. Let me backtrack a little bit with the Pliocene and get to the Eocene. In your study, you did a lot of computer modeling, and you sort of, I think you put like, 2030, sort of the time frame there, if we keep going the way we're going, that we might probably be what the Pliocene was like.
That's right.
And it's sort of interesting that you said that because, as you mentioned, that we're causing the climate change occurring today in the Pliocene. It wasn't that way.
Yeah, right. You know, this
is this going to be something that, could it be cyclical? Could we end up, the 2100 might be a little different, but could we eventually get into another ice age?
It's such a good question. And, you have to really think about the different kind of forces at play here.
Yeah.
Because we know that what has caused those ice ages in the past over these sort of, over the last several hundreds of thousands of years has been these changes in Earth's orbit, changes the amount of sunlight we get in different places. That leads to ice sheets to grow and melt back. And that leads to, like I talked about, the oceans to release and take up CO2.
Okay.
All those things are happening. Yeah.
So the orbit, means that we got closer to the sun that warmed us.
Yep.
And as we rotated, we went further away that cooled us.
Right.
So that was the impetus, I guess, or why it happened then.
It's when it comes to what's causing that change in the Earth's orbit to cause those past ages, it's actually three things. It's how circular the orbit is. It gets more elliptical or more circular.
Okay.
The tilt of the Earth, how much we tilt,
And that's more, changed too over
that's
the millions
changed,
of years
that's
as well.
Too.
Yes, that's right.
And then there's something called precession. You can think of the Earth like a top where it's spinning on its axis.
Okay.
But then the axis is also rotating through space.
Oh my God.
That also changes. That's something called precession. So one cool thing there, we use Polaris as our North Star today. 5,000 years ago, the Greeks or the Sumerians or whoever, they had a different polar star than we do because over that 5,000 years, the Earth has rotated by about 90 degrees in its rotation through space. So anyways, going back to your question about could this be cyclical or not, we have a strong confidence that the current warming is being caused by our greenhouse gas emissions. The science on that is very clear.
Right.
It's also quite clear that the magnitude of the forcing, the amount of warming we're creating by our adding CO2 to the atmosphere is totally dominating and swamping those orbital effects. Those orbital processes I talked about happen too slowly and not strongly enough that they're getting kind of overrun by our greenhouse gas emissions, our anthropogenic.
That was the one thing, studies that have come out have, in fact, some scientists have actually said we got it wrong because it's increasing faster at a faster rate.
Right.
The amount of, and we still keep putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And yet, the effects are happening at a quicker time frame.
Yeah, exactly. And this really gets into projections. And among climate, we base our scenarios of the future and how much we think the world will warm on climate models. When we project forward, we have to work with these Earth system models, these climate models. And it's always a fair question about how good are the models, how accurate are the models. They have been tested extensively. There's lots of benchmarks that people use with these models. I tend to believe that the common statement that comes from these models, if you double CO2 in the atmosphere, then you'd expect about a 3-degree warming worldwide, with uncertainty of maybe a degree and a half to 4.5 degrees. That's the range.
Wow.
This is in Celsius units too.
Yeah.
There's also people who argue, and I think with good reason, that the climate models might be conservative. Like they might tend to underestimate the warming. They might be a little too smooth relative to the true variability of the climate system. I tend to hold that opinion myself.
Yeah. Since you brought that up, I wanted to ask you about that. In your study, you took two scenarios. But I want to ask you about the models you used. Were those ones that you created, or you used some other different ones?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. That's really important. So that paper, a number of the co-authors on the paper were climate modelers from different research groups around the world.
Okay.
Worldwide, there's roughly two dozen or so, you know, research quality, you know, these require supercomputers. These are kind of major efforts to run these large Earth system models. Different groups in the U.S. and internationally run these models. We took previously run simulations run by some of the co-authors on our paper, and then we analyzed those runs for this analysis. So I did not run the models. Kevin Burke, who's a grad student at Wisconsin who led those runs, did not run the models, but we drew upon previously run simulations by our co-authors.
So you basically analyzed the results.
Yeah.
And then compared it.
That's right. And so the real contribution was really working across a whole range of different time scales and comparing those to the future.
Yeah.
What often happens is that the Pliocene people do their runs or the Eocene people do their runs, and they kind of work, you know, trying to understand the climates of the Eocene. What we did was this integrative analysis comparing the climates of the future to those of the Pliocene, the Eocene, the 20th century, the pre-industrial time period.
Specific to the Pliocene and the Eocene, but you took different, a lot of, you know, several different time periods.
Right. We studied six possible analogs from the past to those of the coming decades. And part of the point of that was that we went from relatively recent time periods that represent our lived experience and our instrumental record. So like the mid-20th century, the pre-industrial period, which is a couple hundred years ago, the mid-Holocene, which is about 6,000 years ago, the last interglacial in those glacial interglacial cycles, about 125,000 years ago, and then the Pliocene, 3 million years ago, and the Eocene, 50 million years ago. And so a big finding of our paper was that we're rapidly moving outside of the relatively recent possible analogs and going deeper and deeper into geological history to find good analogs for the climates of the coming decades. So we are moving outside of the range of variation of the Holocene, of our lived experience, and having to go deeper and deeper into geological past to find counterparts for the expected climates of the coming decades.
Well, let me ask you, is because the further back you go, the least amount of evidence you have, how can you basically compare with what you know about the Eocene particularly, that's 50 million years ago?
Yeah, exactly. It's a great question. And we do know a lot. We do have knowledge about where the oceans and continents were. We can do these plate tectonics reconstructions. And Earth system models, because they are complete models of the ocean and the atmosphere, they don't need a lot of inputs. They need to be told where the ocean and the atmospheres were. If you can give them some estimates of carbon dioxide and some other basic input parameters, they'll give you an estimate of the climates of that time period. It's important to know it's an estimate. It's not necessarily the truth. And in the paper, we talk about those caveats, that what we're working with here are paleoclimatic model simulations and future model simulations, and we make those comparisons between those two. And in that sense, they are model dependent.
Yeah, they're model dependent. I wanted to ask you about how confident are you in your accuracy, particularly in the future ones?
It's a great question. I talk about this with students in my class. So let me give a couple answers to that. One is that I use those climate models all the time to understand how species responded to the last ice age. That's the kind of work I do in my own research. A lot of it is understanding why was spruce south of us 20,000 years ago living in Kentucky and Tennessee, and why is it north of us now? And we can use those climate models to make predictions about the kinds of climates that spruce prefers. And that as temperatures rose coming out of the last ice age, that actually predicts quite well the observed range shift of spruce and other taxa. So we, in our own work, do a lot of testing of those climate models against what we know from our fossil records. And that's a big part of the work I do, is using the past to test models and improve models. And what I would say among those of us who use these climate models, I am relatively confident in their temperature predictions. I feel that those are usually accurate within a degree or so, on a global scale. I'm much less confident in their precipitation predictions, because rainfall and cloud physics are harder to get
right
at the large scales of the models. So when I kind of give people what's a useful kind of healthy constructive criticism to think about these models, I tend to place more faith in something like their global temperature predictions and a little bit more caution when it comes to their rainfall scenarios over Wisconsin, say.
Yeah. I think, as I mentioned before, it seems like for climate change, temperature is a big factor in that. Now, let me ask you this on the modeling results. You said that, I think it was 2100, approximately the year 2100, that we'd probably have a climate that resembled a little bit about what the Eocene was. And that temperature is extremely high. I mean, we're at what, about 2 degrees Celsius? I think you said something like that.
We are about a degree or so above sort of early 20th century temperatures right now. We've warmed by about a degree over the last 100 years, degrees Celsius.
Yeah, and the Eocene was extremely way up there. I think if I, I'm not sure if I have the information handy, that it was like, what, 12, maybe more than that, 20 degrees Celsius or something like that?
Yeah, I don't have the exact number on my fingertips, but I think an important, so what the climate models predict is, again, it depends a lot on the scenario. So how much warming we get over by 2100 depends a lot on how much carbon dioxide we put in the atmosphere. So when we do these scenarios, we often work with high-end scenarios, mid-range scenarios,
and low-range scenarios. I'm a pessimist. We're going to put in a lot.
We may just burn it all. We'll see. So part of what we chose was from the range of scenarios that have been produced, we took a high-end scenario, kind of a business as usual, don't slow down
right.
kind of scenario,
yep.
and a mid-range stabilization scenario. And right now, if you actually look at our real carbon dioxide emissions, we're kind of tracking between those two scenarios at
okay.
present. So okay. we hope to, lure and move away from those middle to high end scenarios. But right now, that's a reasonable guess about where we might go. Under that higher under the high end scenario, which called RCP 8.5, we would get maybe a 4 to 5 degree warming by the end of this century. That is not as high as the Eocene. Like you said, the Eocene was warmer than that. But it's warmer than the Pliocene and these other analogs we talked
Definitely
about,
is.
Right?
So, yeah.
So last interglacial is maybe a degree and a half warmer than present. Mid-Holocene, maybe half degree warmer than present. So once you start to get to like 3 to 4 to 5 degrees warming over this century, you really are going back tens of millions of years to find the best analog in the geological record.
Yeah, we ran out of time. I wanted to ask you about what if there's a good positive thing that we can look for, but it took the Eocene, the Eocene, and we didn't have humans, but the Eocene took millions of years to start reducing its temperature. Would we with humans? I'm kind of hoping humans become extinct, and then it'll go down on its own.
Well, when it comes to climate change and thinking about climate change, I think a lot of us who work in the field, like a lot of us who think about it in general, go back and forth between hope and despair, right? There are some real concerning trends. We make the point that the rate of change is very high now compared to these long ago time periods.
Yeah, right.
At the same time, we do know that life and species survived these past climate changes and new evolutionary adaptations arose and so forth. So we can see that history and take hope in that sense. And I also think we can use the past to learn, to prepare. That's what I would really say, is that by understanding the past and having these reference model systems, we can better adapt to and prepare for the climate changes.
Once we, can plan for the future, hopefully we know what the future is going to look like. Maybe we can do something about it and adapt like we're doing now.
Yep.
Thanks a lot, Jack. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation.
Back to you, Matt.
This has been another edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine, brought to you by the Madison Science Radio Collective. Thank you again to our guest Jack Williams for joining us tonight. Engineering the show was Kevin Lauderjung. Dennis Schaefer produced the show. And I'm your host, Matt Blackburn. Please tune in again next week for another exciting edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine. Coming up next is Radio Literature.